If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers, airing weeknights at 12:35, 11:35 Central on NBC, right after The Tonight Show.
President Trump doubled down on his false claims about non-existent voter fraud amid reports of concerns from some people around him about his behavior. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. It hasn't exactly been a reassuring start for the Trump administration, and some people close to Trump seem very eager to give reporters damning details about where he gets his information from, expressing concern in particular that he watches too much TV. Politico reported this week that, quote, one person who frequently talks to Trump said aides have to push back privately against his worst impulses in the White House and have to control information that may infuriate him. He gets bored and likes to watch TV, so it is important to minimize that. Hey, I hear ya. I'm dealing with the same issue with my son. He's 9 months old, and we're trying to observe a no-screens rule, but sometimes he gets cranky, and the only thing that works is Dora the Explorer. So, been there. Been there. So why do Trump's aides have to regulate his TV consumption? Well, according to the Washington Post, Trump has been resentful, even furious, as what he views as the media's failure to reflect the magnitude of his achievements. And he feels demoralized that the public's perception of his presidency so far does not necessarily align with his own sense of accomplishment. Accomplishment? You've been president for 5 days. And it seems like most of that time has been spent signing giant documents and then showing people that you signed them. It's like how you read a book to kids, and then Donnie built a wall, and then there's a picture of the wall. In fact, Trump has apparently been so obsessed with media coverage of his crowds and his so-called achievements that, according to the New York Times, several senior advisors urged him to move on and focus on the responsibilities of office during his first full day as president. Just let that sink in. The president's aides had to urge him to focus on the responsibilities of his office. What's it going to be like in an actual crisis? Mr. President, North Korea has fired a nuke. Hold on. Dora and Boots are helping a baby fish find its mother. So there's a lot going on. Trump staffers are even making snarky comments about how lazy he is, referring to White House counselor Kellyanne Conway. One Trump confidant suggested that Conway's office on the second floor of the West Wing, as opposed to one closer to the Oval Office, was a sign of her diminished standing, and dismissively predicted that Trump would rarely climb a flight of stairs. That sounds right. I think Trump would look at a flight of stairs and say, "This escalator's broken." And then someone close to Trump told the Associated Press that, quote, the bad press over the weekend has not allowed Trump to enjoy the White House as he feels he deserves. Hey, man, you're not supposed to enjoy the White House. That's why dudes go in looking like this and come out looking like this. That's not a guy who is at a super fun party. That's not a guy leaving a carnival. That's a guy who was just visited by 3 ghosts. Only one president ever really enjoyed the White House, and he got impeached for it. The same article continues. Those around Trump are trying to get the cable news consumer-in-chief to be near a television less often. Have you tried hiding the remote someplace you would never look? Like, under the Constitution? And you can see Trump's cable news consumption influencing his thinking in real time. On Tuesday, for example, at 9:25 p.m., Trump tweeted, "If Chicago doesn't fix the horrible carnage going on, I will send in the feds." Where could Trump possibly have gotten that idea? Was it maybe uttered about an hour earlier on cable news?
Gang violence in Chicago getting worse. Will President Trump step in and override local authorities?
If you're going to copy your work, at least change it enough to hide your tracks. Didn't you learn anything from your inauguration speech?
We are transferring power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the people.
We take Gotham from the corrupt, and we give it back to you, the people.
So, Trump.
It's going to be tremendous.
So Trump literally takes his cues from Fox News and Bain, which could be good if we could just find a way to get Bill O'Reilly to say this.
Donald Trump should step down.
Good work. Good work. Trump spent the first few days of his term lying about crowd sizes, and now he's even lying about his own victory in November, repeating in a meeting with congressional leaders and in a series of tweets, the insane and false claim that 3 to 5 million illegal votes cost him the popular vote. Of course, this claim has been repeatedly debunked, including by Trump's own lawyers, who wrote in a legal filing on behalf of the Trump campaign objecting to a recount in Michigan in December that, quote, all available evidence suggests that the 2016 general election was not tainted by fraud or mistake. Donald, I'm going to repeat a phrase I'm sure you've heard many times in court. Listen to your lawyers. Now, you might remember, after the last crowd size debacle, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer promised the White House press corps, quote, our intention is never to lie to you. That's interesting language. Our intention is never to lie to you. It's like saying, I don't want to lie to you, baby, but then you get so upset when I sleep with other girls, you gave me no choice. Given that promise, there's no way Spicer would come out the very next day and repeat Trump's blatant and obvious lies about fake voter fraud, right?
Does the president believe that millions voted illegally in this election? And what evidence do you have of widespread voter fraud in this election, if that's the case?
The president does believe that. He has stated that before, and he continues to maintain that belief based on studies and evidence that people have presented to him.
How can he be comfortable with his win if he believes
he's very comfortable with his win?
3 million votes? Maybe he didn't win.
No, he's very comfortable with his win.
He's very comfortable with his win. It may have seemed small at the time, but you have to remember, in November, it's very cold. Now, maybe Spicer is just a little agitated because, as the Washington Post recently reported, Spicer churns through pieces of Orbit cinnamon gum, which he chews and swallows whole, 2.5 packs by noon, said Spicer. I talked to my doctor about it. He said, it's no problem. Do you share a doctor with Donald Trump? Swallowing gum is good for your stomach and your brain. In fact, the human brain is mostly gum. I learned that from a famous neurosurgeon. So now, because of Trump's lies, it's difficult to believe him on anything policy-related. Like, for example, when he claimed, quote, I was the first and only potential GOP candidate to state there will be no cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. You might remember that to hold him to that promise, Bernie Sanders took to the Senate floor with a giant printout of that Trump tweet. And apparently, Bernie kept the giant tweet because on Tuesday he showed up to the confirmation hearing for Trump's potential Office of Management and Budget Director, Mick Mulvaney, and behind him there was a staffer who was once again carrying the giant Trump tweet. And you know that's the same one because there is no way Bernie doesn't recycle his giant tweets. Bernie probably brings his own paper cup to the deli.
Why waste a new cup when this one is perfectly fine?
And yet, on Tuesday, Mulvaney repeatedly indicated that he would favor cutting these programs despite Trump's promises. Meanwhile, Trump is moving forward with cruel and unnecessary promises to ban refugees and build a Mexican border wall. So if you like a wall, good news. If you like a refugee ban, good news. If you like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, be worried. And remember, when they cut Medicare and you want to go to Mexico for cheap health care, you won't be able to get there because of the wall. This has been Close Roll.
Late Night Podcast is available every Wednesday and Friday on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please take a moment to leave us a rating and review. Now, back to the show.
Our first guest tonight is a 13-time Emmy Award-winning journalist and the global anchor for Yahoo News. Her latest documentary, Gender Revolution, A Journey with Katie Couric, premieres February 6th on Nat Geo. Please welcome to the show, Katie Couric, everybody.
Here. This is my first time on your
first
show,
time on the show. I'm honored to have you.
I'm thrilled to be here. Congratulations. I love watching you.
Thank you so much. Congratulations to you as well. You just had a birthday. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I don't know if you all would be applauding if you knew what birthday it was. The big 6-0.
6-0. I don't think a lot of 60-year-olds rock out like this on their birthday. Look at that.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun. I kind of had a birthday bash because I'm a firm believer in celebrating. I mean, we have to celebrate the good things. And if you reach 60, you're lucky to be here, right? And so I had a big party.
And I have a lot of my friends. That is somebody who's about to drink because your shoes are off.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, I love to dance, so I did a lot of serious dancing that night. Max Weinberg played and the guys, so it was a lot of fun.
And you you also, this was very exciting for Matt Lauer, 20 years at NBC. You came back and hosted the Today Show.
Did you enjoy? I did. It was a lot of fun. You know, it felt like, you know, old times. And I have so many friends who are still working there.
Of course.
You know, Mark Traub, the stage manager, you always hear laughing in the background, even when the things aren't funny. He just sort of tries to encourage
everyone
to laugh.
That's why you can hear him. He's
the exactly. one guy. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You, of course, are still a member of the media. And I have to ask, obviously, this Trump administration, we're in the early days of it, but the media has been cast pretty quickly as an adversary, as it was throughout the campaign. What is your relationship with the Trump administration been so far?
Well, you know, I would love to interview President Trump at some point. He doesn't seem particularly interested in that at this juncture. I'm hoping that he'll change his mind. You know, I think he does consume, as you said earlier, a lot of television. And I don't think he is that internet savvy, except for his Twitter feed, obviously.
Very good at Twitter, yeah.
He's good at Twitter. But because he watches so much television, I don't think he realizes how much news and information is actually consumed online for people. So I'm trying to kind of make sure he realizes that. And I think it's actually, you know, I think it's a bit scary to see such an adversarial relationship with the press, because as he tries to cast doubts on the credibility of a free press, I think he thinks that will prevent anyone from casting doubt on his credibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, we really need a free press to hold any president accountable for what they're doing and to not obsess on these things that he seems to be sidetracked about, whether it was the inauguration crowd size or now these false claims or, you know, specious claims about illegal voting. And I think, you know, hopefully they'll both institutions will get their acts together, because we really need a free press to cover this administration desperately.
There is some press he likes, because you were in his office during the campaign and you noticed something in his office.
Yeah, it was interesting. I went by to say hello, you know, kiss the ring and all that stuff that you have to do sometimes. And I noticed he has a huge, huge desk at his office in Trump Tower. And there was every magazine that he had been on the cover of, like 10 issues deep. And he'd been on the cover of a lot of magazines, Seth. So his entire desk was covered with various publications. And I was thinking, wow, you know, that's interesting decor for an office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is. It's, I mean, like, it would be, it's like when I'm in the newspaper, my mom gets 10 of them.
My parents used to make scrapbooks for me.
My mom makes a scrapbook, too.
Yeah, which was so sweet.
But you're not president. That's true. Sorry, Mom.
wasn't a diss.
I want to talk
Maybe
about...
Maybe you should run, by the way,
No,
Seth.
No, thank you. It doesn't pay anywhere near enough. So I want to talk about Gender Revolution. This is a documentary you made for Nat Geo. And it's a really nice timing for something like this, because I think everyone's perceptions of gender are changing. Did you go into this with a full education on it, or did you learn throughout the process?
Not at all. I mean, I have been actually very interested in this for several years because increasingly I saw so much coverage of this, obviously with Caitlyn Jenner giving it huge, visibility. And I was so interested in how our definition of gender is changing. Millennials, 50% of millennials think that gender's on a spectrum. But somebody like me, a cisgender, thank you, someone who identifies with the gender I was born with, who grew up in a very binary world of male-female, which is how I start the documentary, it's hard to wrap your head around. Even very progressive friends of mine have, you know, trouble with this whole changing concept of gender. And then when my daughter, who's a junior in college, said they go around the room in discussion groups, they say their names and their pronouns. And I thought, wow, we're really witnessing a transformational time in terms of gender. So I'm embarked on this journey to really educate myself with using what I hope was respectful curiosity and talking to the people who are behind the headlines, the people whose lives are being affected by this and who are adjusting to this, and the institutions like Yale that are adjusting to this changing perception.
And it's not just the perception, but obviously along with that comes there's a new vocabulary.
Yes.
And you actually, I'd like to show a clip of you talking. Was this at Yale?
This was with the Yale students.
Okay,
that's right.
Let's take a look.
Okay.
My name is Matthew, and I am a junior. And I use they, them, their.
They, them, theirs. Mm-hmm. What exactly does it mean to be they, them, and theirs?
When I was first going through the initial stages of my transition, there was a time period where I was trying to get people to use he, him, his. And like, that was maybe less wrong than she, her, hers, but wasn't quite right either. So I started trying out they, them, theirs. And I was just like, this feels good. Like, this feels right.
People are always saying, oh, but they is a plural pronoun. Like, how can I refer to a single person that way? But in my head, I think, well, I am plural.
It's very interesting, and I think it's very helpful to watch things like this and conversations like that because it's natural to have an ignorance for this.
Right.
I don't think that people should be ashamed for not fully understanding what's happening
here.
Well,
one of those Yale students, Seth, said what's required is radical patience. And I think for everyone to kind of adjust with this new normal, that everyone kind of has to give themselves a little room to sometimes make mistakes. So I hope this will be a really good learning tool for people to not only understand the new vernacular, but to also understand the people who this is affecting. Like, you know, I talked to a mom and her transgender daughter, and this her daughter contemplated suicide at age 7. And trans people are, the suicide rate among trans people is almost 50% compared to 4.6 for the general population. So a lot of people say we'd rather have a transgender child than a dead child. And I don't think people understand what a struggle this is, that they don't make this decision cavalierly. And there's a whole process and medical professionals and psychological professionals. So I really take a number of stories that will, you know, make it hard for people to be so afraid and to be full of hate when they get to know the real people behind them,
well,
behind
the
stories.
I'm so glad you did it. It's really fantastic.
And can we say that your mother-in-law helped with the teaching guide?
Yes, now she'll be very happy that you did.
Well,
and it'll be very embarrassing that I wasn't going to. Yeah. Katie Couric, everybody. Gender Revolution is February 6th on Nat Geo. We'll be right back with Bryce Dallas Howard.
Hey, this is Kevin. I'm one of the producers here at Late Night. We're backstage with Katie Couric, award-winning journalist and host of the Katie Couric podcast. She's here to tell us a little bit more about her new documentary, Gender Revolution. There's a lot of personal stories in the documentary. There's a lot of subject matter. Can you give us some more details about what you touch on in the documentary?
Sure. I really wanted to, in a way, take a survey chronologically from birth till old age, because I think there's a lot of confusion about the steps that perhaps trans people would take on their journey to really confirming their gender identity. And I talk a lot about what the science is saying right now about things that happen in utero. And also what I talked to a family where a 4-year-old boy said he was a girl and the family supported that decision. And I tried to ask some of the questions that many people would ask, like, how does a child that age know with certainty that he, in fact, is a transgender girl, or that's the gender with which he identifies. And then I talk a lot about puberty blockers, and then I visited a transgender surgeon who does a lot of gender confirmation surgery, and then I interviewed a couple. The transgender woman had gender confirmation surgery when she was 70 years old, and her wife stayed with her. And I've always been fascinated by not only the people who are going through this and struggling with this issue, but also their partners and how it affects them. And finally, I ended with a conversation between Hari Neff, who's a very well-known transgender activist, but also a model and actor, and Renee Richards, who's such a pioneer in this. And I noticed there's a pretty significant generational divide between how Renee sees this and how Hari sees it. And then, you know, I also talked to some Yale students. So I really tried to kind of follow the path that many people and sort of society at large is facing when it comes to this gender revolution.
You touch on the difference between sexual orientation and gender identification. Can you just kind of give us a what the difference is? Because I think that's an important thing to understand in all this.
These are all such new concepts, and there's so much new vocabulary about this, but often people conflate sexual orientation with gender identification, and they really have nothing to do with each other. And the easiest way I was able to kind of ingest this was Sam Killerman, one of the folks I interviewed, said, sexual orientation is who you go to bed with, gender identification is who you go to bed as. And, you know, one really doesn't have anything to do with the other. And I think, you know, even simple things like that are I think, new concepts for a lot of people. And I'm hoping that by going on this journey with me, where I hopefully was, as I mentioned to Seth, respectfully curious, and I asked direct questions. I asked Kate Rohr's wife, Linda, I said, so you're staying with Kate after 45 years of marriage. Are you a lesbian now? You know, and I think she didn't mind the question. I think to have an open conversation, and yes, maybe I'll make some mistakes and I'll get confused at times, but I'm hoping it will give permission for people to ask questions and feel that it's okay if they don't understand it all.
All right, Katie, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And,
yeah, it was great. Come back.
Fun talking with you next to the cheese platter, Kevin.
The old cheese platter, yeah. Yeah.
Our next guest is a best-selling author and contributing editor for Rolling Stone. His latest book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus, is available now. Please welcome to the show, Matt Taibbi, everybody. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Congratulations on the book, Insane Clown President, comes from what you, because you covered this from the beginning.
Right.
The insane clown car that was the Republican primary.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And you referred to those 17 candidates as 17 platypuses trying to mount the Queen of England. Which is very evocative. It's a very nice turn of the phrase. Were you happy when you came up with that?
I was trying to think of something that was obscene enough to represent what I thought I was seeing with my eyes. And that was the only thing I could come up with.
Yeah. One of the, obviously right now, and we talked about it earlier in the show, President Trump is attacking the press a lot. He's attacking journalists. He did it throughout the entire campaign. Do you think there's a fair criticism of the media and insofar as how they cover him?
Insofar as how we cover him, you know, that's a different question. In general, of course, there's a fair criticism of us because we don't know anything. If we knew anything, we'd be doing something else for a living.
Right.
You know, I met a lot of people on the trail who would say things like, you know, you people in the media are always trying to tell me how to live, but you don't even know how to fix an oil filter. And that's true. You know,
yeah.
I think there's a lot of resentment about the media that is grounded in reality. And Trump very cannily exploited a lot of those feelings.
You go back and forth, and obviously this book sort of, you know, takes place throughout your covering of it.
Right.
There are times where you think this is all hilarious.
Right.
And there are times then that you think it's terrifying, and you kind of go back and forth. Are you still going back and forth?
Yeah, no, I'm sure as anybody who has a sense of humor feels that we're deeply conflicted because on the one hand, it's the funniest thing that's ever happened to this country, you know. on the other hand, you know, it's potentially the end of civilization. And, you know, but does that make it funnier? Like, I don't know. I mean, it's terrible and awful and hilarious all at the same time. And, you know, that it made it difficult to know even how to think about the entire thing because, you know, obviously you have to have a strategy for covering any candidate. And in the beginning of this book, it's pretty clear I was covering this as a comedy. I thought this was all very funny. And then it took this very dark turn in the middle where it's, you know, where we had to start thinking seriously about what did this all mean? And of course, it became weightier there.
You talk a little bit, and obviously there's been a lot of talk about the idea of a bubble and people being inside a bubble. You travel with the reporters, so you're with people who cover this. Can sort of a groupthink set in where everybody has the same take on how the election's going to go?
Yeah, there's a kind of Stockholm syndrome that sets in, and this is something that I've noticed. You know, going back to the first campaign I covered back in 2004, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but the campaign is really like a traveling prison. You know, it's so airtight. Once the Secret Service gets involved, like, you know, back in those days, I had to smoke. When I was smoking, you had to actually ask somebody to get you cigarettes because you can't escape the bubble. So you're literally trapped inside the plane with the candidate's aides, and those are the only people you talk to. And what happens when you're in the same environment with the same people day after day, week after week, you start to adopt each other's values, whether you want to or not. And I think that's what happened with the politicians and the media this time around. They got so used to each other and so used to relying upon each other to take the temperature of America that they didn't listen to what people were actually saying. And I think that was a major factor in Trump's rise.
So, you know, we're going to obviously, everything goes all right, we're going to have another presidential election. And
if the world doesn't end before then.
We don't know. Or will they just decide never to hold one again? But if they do, so how, you know, will the press cover the next election differently? Or will candidates, I'm giving you a lot of questions here, are candidates going to adopt the Trump model? Like, what can the press do differently next time out?
So here's the problem. You know, Trump's brilliant innovation was to realize that the campaign trail story is just a big reality show. And it was a sucky, boring reality show. And then he turned it into an engrossing, impossible to miss reality show. And I think what's going to happen in the future is that politicians are going to try to run their campaigns like Trump did, trying to stay in the news not just every day, but every second, every minute. You know, that was a key to his strategy. And I don't know how the press gets away from that because, you know, financially, they're dependent also on hits and eyeballs and ratings. Yeah. And so it's very difficult to not make it into a circus and a show. And any politician who does that, the press is probably going to follow.
I will say, don't you think, though, I mean, just to compliment him, he's better at this. Like, he's so naturally good at that. I feel like anyone else who tried to do it would be ham-fisted and weird.
Oh, yeah.
Like, anyone who says, I'm going to run Donald Trump's campaign, I think it would fail.
Oh, there was a moment in this campaign, I remember it, Ted Cruz in New Hampshire trying to do, you know, imitations from the Princess Bride. He actually wasn't bad,
yeah.
but it was which was depressing for me because I love that movie. But, you know, the attempt to try to be a Trumpian character.
Well, and Marco Rubio, who all of a sudden thought he could get into a flame war with Donald Trump. It was kind of pathetic to watch.
It was, yeah, because no one has the total lack of self-awareness. And yeah. You know, I mean, Trump just outclasses all of them in the areas.
Yeah.
And
it's not that, like, in order to be Trump, you don't need to read a bunch of books. It's almost like they need to take a part out of your brain.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Or you got to eat like a...
Yeah. I'm so glad you're out there. Congratulations on the book. I've been a big fan for a long time. Thanks for making the time for us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's how you be, everybody. The Same Time President is available now. We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Henry. I am a segment producer here at Late Night. Matt Taibbi just talked to Seth, and I'm backstage with him, and I'm going to ask him a little bit more about his personal history with 30 Rock. Matt, so we're obviously taping this in 30 Rock. You've spent a lot of time in 30 Rock. Your dad was a reporter here for a long time.
Yeah, I spent a lot of my teen years in this building, actually. My father was a reporter dating back to the mid-80s. He worked for WNBC, and then he worked for Dateline. So he used to have an office on the sixth floor here, and he had a little fake golf putting green. So all the people on the floor would come and play golf in his office. So, yeah, it brings back a lot of memories to come in here always.
Yeah, so did that make you want to be a reporter? Like, how early in your life did you know you wanted to follow in his footsteps?
Well, I never wanted to be a reporter. I wanted to be a novelist growing up. Mm. Although my father is obviously, he's a hero of mine. I mean, I you know, worshipped him from day one growing up. And as a reporter, he's the model that I, you know, aspire to. I, you know, he taught me really everything I know about this business, but I wanted to be a funny novelist. It just turned out that my fiction kind of sucks. So this is the family business and this is what I know. And so I kind of fell back on this early in my 20s. And so that's how I ended up in his business.
What was some of your worst early fiction?
Oh, I wouldn't even want to bring up any of the titles that, you know, it's funny, there's probably 100 things you need to be a really good fiction writer, and I probably have a few of them, but I just have a total inability to invent facts. Everything I write just comes out completely lifeless and dead. And when I go back and read it now, I'm actually really horrified. Like, wow, that is like the worst writer in history. So, yeah.
Well, I'm very glad you were doing what you were doing now. Such a pleasure having you. Please come back soon.
Thanks so much, Henry.
Appreciate
it.
Thank you.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. Thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.